Mr. Martin as well. So our next case, Chipley's, Mr. Hase.
May it please the court, I'm Assistant Attorney General Richard Huzzack, counsel for the state of Illinois, and I urge the court to reverse the lower court's holding that the 2006 amendments to the Public Utilities Act.
So in other words, you think that what Illinois can do is simply revise bankruptcy priorities retroactively.
But the argument has never been made that this is a violation.
In other words, you say, well, we make a contract, we borrow money, and we say to the lender, you know, get that money back. You get your money back on certain conditions, and then later you say, well, actually, we want the money. Illinois wants the money, so we're changing the conditions, and so you're not going to get your money back.
That sounds
to me like retroactively altering bankruptcy priorities.
There's never been an argument that this is a violation of the bankruptcy laws. These are all post-petition debts, administrative
liabilities.
No, I'm
speaking generally. I know bankruptcy isn't state law and so on. But, you know, there's a contracts clause in the Constitution, so I don't see how the state can lend money on one set of terms and then come along and say, well, you thought you had a priority to be repaid, but we've decided we don't want to do that anymore. We need the money. We're broke. We're a broke state, so we're not going to pay our debts, you know.
Well, I think, Your Honor, you're attributing to the
legislature. Maybe they can do it by saying explicitly, but no one's going to want to do business with the state of Illinois if it decides that any time it alters the law, that has a retroactive application.
Our position is that provided the statute clearly indicates the application of these amendments, which
but
is certainly no reference to
it
retroactivity.
It doesn't have the express statement that the statute on statutes calls for.
The statute on statutes refers to the manifest intention of the legislature in Section 1 of the statutes. And an interpretation following the substance versus procedure, a dichotomy in Section 4, provided that it's not repugnant to the context of the statute itself.
Well, but there's no express statement in this 2006 amended statute that it applies retroactively. Nothing whatever. And your argument that the state, you know, otherwise this would all be a gift, is crazy. Every lender who lends to a company that later goes into bankruptcy discovers to its chagrin that it may not get all of the money back because the bankrupt entity may not be able to pay all the money back. That's the only thing that happened to you. If this company had kept on producing, you know, electricity from the methane and the solid waste, this turns out to be an idea. We've had other cases about this. It really didn't work too well. But, you know, you would have been collecting money under these new terms, and the district judge gave you the prospective application. There's nothing that distinguishes you from any other lender in bankruptcy.
None of the issues in this case involve bankruptcy.
Yes, they do, though, because the reason that these facilities can't keep paying back the loans, this transfer, the extra money that's paid to the utility, and then ComEd gets the tax credits, and then we understand how all that works.
Okay.
But so I'm just kind of calling it a loan.
And they stipulated it was a loan.
Right.
But some of these questions.
All companies that loan money to somebody else who eventually ceases operating and seeks the protection of the bankruptcy laws don't get repaid in full. And if you want to call it a gift, go ahead and call it a gift. But it doesn't make it a gift. It's just a loan that doesn't get repaid.
Let me start with the first premise, and I understand the court has trouble with that proposition, then move to the second and third, which it sounds like the court has trouble with this as well. But respectfully, our position is that the statute need not explicitly state that it's intended to be retroactive.
Okay, what does it need to
it
do?
It needs to be unambiguous with respect to the legislative intention that the
that's a total garble. First you say it needn't be explicit. Then you say it has to be unambiguous as to intent. What are you talking about?
The only reasonable interpretation of the statute
But it easily can be reasonably interpreted to be prospective. Most statutes are prospective. What's unreasonable about that interpretation?
Okay, if we're starting on the premise that there need not be an explicit statement. Here's the way it works.
The introductions. I asked a very simple question. Why is it unreasonable for the statute to apply prospectively?
Okay, these are the reasons. The statute refers in undifferentiated fashion, after the three repayment triggers were added to it, continues to refer to the repayment of a single obligation, and that is the actual reduction in tax payments. There's
which
nothing
would be happening if this company hadn't folded.
Well, the actual reduction in tax payments is the amount of the subsidy. So what I'm saying is that the statute refers to that single obligation, not a multi-part obligation. There's nothing in the statute that says we're now differentiating between old and new subsidies that create this single obligation.
But that's the whole point. It's completely ambiguous. It could easily be read, as most statutes are, especially in light of Section 4, to be prospective. There's nothing inevitable about either ruling, and that's why Illinois has tried to take cases like this off the table by enacting Section 4.
Whether you buy the argument I'm making or not, it is our position that, given the single obligation, the addition of two new triggers to trigger the timing of the repayment of the obligation, not whether there's an obligation in the first place, but the timing of the repayment, which is essentially filling unanticipated gaps. And I think the example we've given is if somebody loans his nephew money so that he can go to college and says, when you graduate, that's when you'll start paying me $1,000 a year, and then the nephew drops out of college, it doesn't cease being an obligation.
But the reason that's a bad example, suppose I borrow, $50,000 from Chase Bank, and they say to me in the loan agreement, you don't have to start repaying anything until 5 years from now. And at that point, here's how much, the interest is going to be. Actually, Home Depot does stuff like this all the time, although it's 1 year in that case. And then, so I plan my financial affairs. I don't think I'm going to have to come up with the $50,000 until 5 years has elapsed. And then in year three, they say, oh, we were just kidding. You have to repay it all now. I would have a very good claim to say, no, I don't. Our agreement is that you were giving me the use of this $50,000 for 5 years.
And in the private context where you're dealing on a contractual...
Infringe the obligation of contract.
There's no argument that this is a violation of the obligation of contracts.
Oh, wow.
That's a non-starter. And so the state has the regulatory authority with a statutory loan program.
Why is it a non-starter? I don't understand. You have contracts with government.
You're calling it a loan. You just insisted that it's a loan.
It's in the nature of a loan, but that addresses the issue of is it an obligation or not, or is it essentially, do the amendments deal with the timing of the repayment of what was an existing obligation? And our position is that
what if you have a student loan and it's supposed to be repaid over a period of years? You emerge from college owing $200,000 or something, and then the government says, oh, by the way, we've added a trigger. When you reach the age of 21, you have to repay the whole thing back, right?
I think
that wouldn't work, would it?
If the government's taking a private contract and saying, now we're basically changing the terms in favor of one part.
About a public contract.
The loan is with the government?
Yeah, the federal government.
It
finances,
whatever.
If it's embodied in a written contract, that may be a different analysis. But this is essentially a statutory loan program where the state is sovereign.
A written contract and a statutory contract. It's still a contract. You don't think it's a contract?
They haven't argued that this is an impairment of the obligation of contracts, and so I'm not going to, urge the court to adopt an argument that they haven't made and is forfeited. They've argued a substantive due process challenge to retroactivity, which I think in light of the the Ussery versus Turner Elkhorn
cases
and others.
With all this in the background, doesn't that cast light on whether this should be given retroactive effect?
I don't think it informs the analysis.
Retroactive effect to when the effect would be to violate the contracts clause, but it doesn't matter in this case because they didn't raise the point. It's still kind of odd.
It's our position that it doesn't. Doesn't violate substantive due process, doesn't violate the impairment of the obligation of contracts clause. It's not a taking. None of those arguments are meritorious, and if the court wants additional briefing, I'd be glad to give it. Our position, very succinctly, is when the legislature was closing unanticipated gaps with respect to the timing of repayment to ensure repayment of the full obligation, it's not reasonable to attribute to it.
Many statutes are enacted to close loopholes. And sometimes they'll make them like, you know, retroactive to for 100 days or something like that, so that people didn't, you know, learning that the statute was going to be passed, didn't take advantage of the loophole. But it's very rare that the loophole is closed retroactively.
Well, the R.A. Gray case.
It's obviously a loophole. I mean, what is the loophole? It's just a condition in a contract.
The other side's argument is much like the movie The Producers. We were counting on failing, and therefore we were going to get this money based upon our anticipation of.
I don't see that at all. Actually, they weren't counting on failing. They thought this business was going to work, and as it happens, the legislature hadn't foreseen the failure option, and so a different set of rules intervened when the bankruptcy was filed, which affected the state's ability to get repaid.
That's all correct, except I think the suggestion that the bankruptcy had anything to do with the amendment. The fact that this...
So you don't think that in the bankruptcy the state wanted to present a claim that it was owed a certain amount of money? That's why you're here. This is called In Re Resource Technology.
I understand it arises, but this is all post-petition liabilities, and the operative issue is a question of state law. And what prompted this legislation was the gaming of the system by this operator who was piping in, you know, natural gas from off-site and claiming subsidies for it, and all of a sudden people said, wait a minute, what's going on here? We have people that are essentially, you know, gaming the system, not in good faith, and the fact that they may then wind up...
So this is a statute aimed at one company?
It was addressed to a problem whose occurrence was signaled by the activities of one company.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Hussain.
Thank you,
Mr.
Your Honor.
Good morning. Good morning, Your Honors. I think you have hit the nail on the head. I think the language is clear. It does not provide for retroactivity. There's nothing here that is at all that would give the credence that it should be effective retroactively. They could have written that in. They did not. I think it's a very clear case here, and I think they're just trying to get some money that they didn't get. And that's all it is. It's nothing more complicated than that.
And so is it your position that this company is forever relieved of the obligation to reimburse the state for the cost of these tax credits that ComEd got?
Any ones that occurred prior to the amendment, yes, Your Honor. Because that is what the statute provides. And it's quite explicit. They could have added the retroactivity again. They did not.
So they could go tomorrow and pass a new statute that has a section in it that says this new statute is expressly designed to be retroactive all the way back to 1987 when the first subsidy law was passed.
I'm not saying that's appropriate either. I'm just saying they
didn't.
Well, I
know you don't want them to do that, but at least this argument wouldn't be on the table. That one would be retroactive, whatever other issues you might want to raise would be there.
Right. They would have, at least it would have had the indicia of a retroactivity argument, which is not incumbent or inherent in this current statute. And again,
so your thought is really that the Illinois General Assembly was failed to have enough foresight to realize that some companies might never be in a position to repay all of the capital costs.
I think that is true, Your Honor. And in fact, I did represent the trustee in this case, Mr. Steinberg, in another case involving methane gas against the state, and that was the issue that was in the state court. I think they recognized the statute was not written the way they wanted it to be written, and 20 years later they tried to amend it, and now they're trying to make it retroactive, even though it doesn't provide for that.
Now, did any facilities with this solid waste conversion actually succeed, or was this really just a failed thought?
I think it's a failed enterprise, Your Honor. And it's my understanding, again, representing Mr. Steinberg in another, representing him as a receiver in a methane gas facility, as a receiver for a bank, many of these facilities went afoul and went under.
Mm-hmm. It's odd in a way. Methane is just natural gas, and natural gas is a fuel like oil, and oil is used, you know, to create electricity. Why was it such a flop?
I don't know. I just know that my experience in these two particular matters is dismal failures. It's not even like it was a borderline.
Close.
So, okay. Yeah. So I really have nothing else to add.
Thank well, thank you, Mr. Bernstein. Mr. Hazzard, do you have anything further?
Really, just only briefly, Your Honor. The court obviously has carefully considered the issues. It is our position that the original statute was imperfectly drafted. The amendment was intended in a rational way to deal with the unanticipated eventuality that came about, that's constitutional. It's also the only reasonable interpretation of that in the context of the entire statute, that it applied to the entire obligation, including prior subsidies, which is the only language that the statute uses, triggered by whichever occurs first of any of the three triggers. This was not a failed program. They phased it out, but as I'm aware of, this is the only enterprise that basically gamed the system and went under, leaving everybody unhappy. But that's not a reason to declare the statute itself prospective only if the language of the statute read as a whole necessarily requires the other interpretation, that it would apply both to prospective and retrospective subsidies, make that the only reasonable one. So,
okay.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you to both counsel.